Met fans, welcome back to another edition of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel of Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2t.org. I'm John Arezzi. The amazing roller coaster continues for the New York Mets right now. They're still right there in the playoff picture. Currently the third and final wild card team in the National League with just a few weeks to go in the 2025 regular season. We will discuss it all in just a bit with baseball insider for SNY, Andy Martino. And then later, a great talk-in with TC Rewind with Curtis Granderson, who will be on Team Citi Field in the upcoming Alumni Classic. And we will have another T2T story to share with you featuring Terry Collins. Let's get right to the leadoff and bring on our friend, one of the top baseball insiders in the game, covering both New York teams for SNY.TV and Baseball Night in New York, Andy Martino. Andy, welcome back.
Hello, John. How are you? You're not on the ledge.
I'm not on the ledge. I was in New York for a week. I'm heading back next week. And, you know, the reality is it is what it is. But I can't remember. And I go way, you know, obviously, you know, I go way back. I can't remember a season that has taken so many twists and turns, ups and downs, storylines that have taken the Met fans on a literal roller coaster ride, really, since, and you have to start before the season and even the offseason, Alonso, Soto. So this entire season has been just a menagerie of so many different things.
Can I challenge you on this point? I'm going to have to ask you to go way back in your memory.
Okay.
To think about what happened in the 2024 season. And my question is, are you sure that this is unique this year? Because I seem to remember at the beginning of September in 2024 being like, well, the Mets, whatever. They're too frustrating. They're too up and down. In fact, I think they were behind the Diamondbacks for the wild card, if not by this point, pretty soon, you know, pretty close before. So are you sure that this hasn't happened in a while?
I think in a different way, just because of, you know, the dilemma with the starting pitching. Mm-hmm. The signing of a free agent for $765 million, who initially was like, this guy's not happy. And, you know, he's not doing this or he's not doing that. He's not animated and he's not hitting. And it's like every few weeks there's a different emotion. You know, you had, you know, the injuries that have taken place. And it's really the starting pitching, the relief pitching, the uncertainty, the starting off red hot, like red hot. Is this going to be a cakewalk? We're going to win the division easy. And then, you know, the collapse, you know, beginning June 13th. And now the bounce back in a little bit of a way. But now you got so many different question marks where it seemed like last year, even if there was a slight dip, it was such a feel-good season, you weren't expecting it.
Weren't they 11 games under 500 at one point last year?
Last season?
Yeah, 2024,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, right. It was in May. Yeah, it was like towards the end of May. And then they turned it around in June after the call.
And so there was once they were up, you felt like it was more of an up.
Yeah, then it was kind of like, it's a feel-good story, all my OMG, all the good stuff. Yeah. All the good vibes and the chemistry of the team, which just led to, you know, some such – phenomenal stuff. And of course, you know, at the end of last season, you're like, all right, they're going to be eliminated. They're not going to win in Atlanta and then Milwaukee. Then, you know, they're just an inch away from being eliminated. And Pete hits the home run. But this year is just kind of like the high expectations and then the uncertainty. And that's the biggest thing right now is the uncertainty with the pitching staff. It's just, I've never seen anything quite like this.
Yeah, it's very, now that I'm wholeheartedly on board with that point, because who would have, it's a very unique situation when you have all of your veteran, highly paid pitchers, like almost are in need of being discarded for the time being. And now you have a bunch of rookies who might be more effective in the postseason. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that a Jonah Tong should ever pitch in a postseason. We've seen him in one game, and yet it's not ridiculous because Minaya and Senga aren't getting it done. So you got to take a look at a Jonah Tong. So that is weird to say you've got this whole wave of young pitching coming up. which is cool and all, but like now, it's a weird time for a sea change in your rotation, right?
Yeah,
September.
The pressure, and with the rookies, it's how do you, you know, Nolan McLean has handled it really well. He looks like the real thing. Jonah, mm-hmm. with one start, we don't know, you know, how he's going to handle major league pitching.
Sproat's going to pitch soon too, so we'll get another data point on that. So that'll be
So that's what you've heard about. I was going to ask you about Sproat. Yeah. He's kind of being like, all right, when do we bring him up? When do we put him in? How do we use him?
I think he'll get a start very much in the near term. In fact, I think by the time this episode is out, we'll probably know which day or soon after. So that's coming.
Yeah, and the Kodai Senga thing is a really interesting storyline right now, because here's a guy that obviously after he came back from the hamstring injury, he's just not been right. He started off great, and now he's kind of like, you can't put him back out there. And the Mets have asked him to go to get an assignment to AAA, and he has not given them an answer yet.
We happen to be taping today while a bunch of fluid situations are going on. So the answer at 11:28 a.m. Eastern on September 4th is that the Mets and Senga's camp are in discussions about this, and they'll get a resolution probably in the next 24-ish hours from where we sit as we're having this conversation, John. So that's what's going on, is they're talking about how this would go, like the details of what he's going down, what's he going down for, how long. I'm sure those are some of the things being discussed. This isn't a case of obviously sending down, I don't know, a Reed Garrett's an optionable guy. He was down last year. I'm just trying to think of an example off the top of my head. Guys that are more in the optionable part of their career. Senga is an established starter, obviously. It's more just like, can you go down there and get right, because the Mets can't afford to have him do it up here right now.
No, and he's been pretty transparent. He doesn't know what's going on. And for him to now have the front office saying we need you to spend some time in AAA to get right, if there's not an injury related situation that we don't know about, how could the guy, you know, honestly say no to that, to try to fix himself, and knowing that his starts have not been productive, and he may hurt the team if he doesn't try to find out what's wrong with him, and they're paying him a lot of money. So even though he has the right to say no, I'm not going down there, I think, you know, it would be the right thing for him to say, let me see how if I could get fixed in the minors, especially with the postseason upon us and just less.
Well, yeah, probably. But I will say, I've covered guys in these situations over the years that have declined assignments. And I always try to remind myself and the audience that they fought. That's the right. Their agent and them got that in their contract. Yeah. They have that right. It's easy for us to say, in a sense, like, if SNY was like, you're covering Binghamton for a while, you need some work on your stuff, I'd be like, I live in New York. So I understand if Senga's feeling like, I'm not saying he is. In fact, I bet you this works out.
Yeah.
But I do understand that it's his right. I understand that once you're on the big league club, I don't think we realize how much once you're off, you're off. You're out of sight, out of mind. So he would be wondering, like, am I coming back? Am I going to pitch in the playoffs? I learned this years ago when Ike Davis was sent to Las Vegas after a couple of years in establishing himself in the big leagues. And I went to Las Vegas to cover that. It was a big story at the time. He was a big name. And when I saw Ike out there, I was kind of saying, oh, you know, you get down here, you get right. And he's just like, no, I'm off the team, bro. You don't understand. Like, I'm off the team. Until I'm not off the team, like, I'm off. And that doesn't feel good. So that's a hard decision for these guys.
Yeah. It's got to be. It's just a fluid situation, as you mentioned, and with the two rookies in there now. I don't know what it would be like to be Carlos Mendoza right now. Not only having to manage the starting rotation, who still can't go deep into games except for Nolan at this point, and then you have the bullpen situation to handle, and you thought that was resolved with the trade deadline and the acquisitions that were made. And Ryan Helsley continues to be a nightmare out of the pen, and he was using a high leverage situation and couldn't handle it again. And it seems like the entire team has rallied behind him, but you throw him out there and he hasn't been able to do anything right. So what kind of pressure is that on the organization as a whole, as this is the guy that was, you know, the major league leader in saves last year, and he comes into a situation and he can't get anybody out. So that's a major problem for this team heading into
the season. No doubt. It's a major problem. They're supposed to have this airtight bullpen coming out of the trade deadline. It's been tough. That look, this is, I think people sometimes want to believe with baseball executives, David Stearns and anybody else, that all right, hire a genius and they're going to do everything right and everything's going to be fine. But they're always just placing bets on these players. And last year, the Stearns administration hit with almost all the pitchers they signed. And this year hasn't worked out.
Yeah.
Trade deadline was tough. Gregory Soto's been pretty good, right? Rogers has been okay. Center field situation didn't get resolved at the trade deadline like it was supposed to have. So it's tough. I think industry-wide, this isn't just a Mets observation, John, but on the Helsley thing, for example, there have been so many cutbacks in pro scouting, and like meaning the guys, when I first started covering the game, and I'm not that old, in the week or two before the trade deadline, every game you go to, there'd be like 10 or more scouts, pro scouts from other teams looking at trade deadline targets. And this is very rare now. The Mets did not have a scout look at Helsley before they made that trade. Oh. They weren't the only team that didn't. So this isn't a Mets specific criticism.
Yeah.
They rely on video and things like that. But maybe there's a reason why a good scout can help say, he's tipping. This might not be the time to trade for him or little things like that. So that might be something they could look at in their process at the end of the season.
Yeah, the bullpen navigation and the starting rotation navigation is – I wouldn't wish that job on anybody right now.
Especially you say how's Carlos doing? I'm sure he's feeling it. These are tough times. And he wanted, as any manager would, he wanted a lot of pitching help at the deadline. And the front office tried, and it just hasn't panned out.
Yeah. Yeah, you could see him. The frustration is there, but he's like he's searching for answers. And you know, everyone's getting paid a lot of money. And you know, when you think things are right, then you get monkey wrenches thrown into the mix all the time. So
100%. Now on the bright side, they're on the because of. I mean, they've won a lot more than they had been winning, obviously. And then the Reds have completely collapsed.
Yeah.
So the Mets do have some cushion to work this kind of stuff out now without worrying every single day if they're going to stay in wild card position. I'm not going to jinx anything. It's only September 4th, but it's not exactly a white knuckle thing right now in terms of the wild card standing. So and they're actually creeping up on San Diego. So
yeah, it's one game behind them as we
say. They've earned themselves a little cushion for this stuff, which is probably why on what day is today? Thursday. On Wednesday, when Mendoza brought in Helsley with a run deficit. You probably don't do that if you have a half game lead in the wild card. So they have a little, but with a cushion, you can say like, we got to get Helsley right. We're better in the playoffs. Yeah. So I don't fault him for trying that because they've earned themselves that. It's not a daily grind over staying in playoff position, which is nice.
Yeah. Mendoza keeps saying, we got to get him right. We have to get Helsley right. We have to do it. And they're trying. So we'll see. That'll be another interesting storyline as the season comes to a conclusion here. Juan Soto, let's talk about Juan. I always love talking about him with you. He's woken up in obviously a very big way. He's on fire. He's doing it all right now. The grand slam the other day, just the big smile on his face, hitting in clutch situations. And it's truly so much fun to watch him right now, especially when we're finally seeing, you know, the clutch hitting, the home runs.
Yeah.
And the numbers alone have just been phenomenal. The fact that he's in, has snuck into the conversation for MVP at this point of the season.
I mean, in terms of finishing second or third, but Shohei Ohtani pitches and hits, right? And at a high level. So that's that. I mean, that MVP thing. With as long as Ohtani, it was funny. And to show I'm not a homer in New York, like I remember when Judge hit the 62, it was like Judge versus Ohtani for the MVP that year. And Judge won, but I would have supported Ohtani. It was like, listen, and this sounds like a joke, but it's not. For Judge to have been the MVP over Ohtani that year, he would have had to be the Yankees setup man at minimum, in addition to hitting 62 home run. That's how ridiculous it is what Ohtani does. By the same token, if, I don't know, David Peterson DH'd on the day that he didn't pitch and he hit 12 home runs this year, that's my National League MVP. It's so amazing to do both. So that's the end of that award, as long as Ohtani's doing what he's doing. But to your point, how fun it is to watch Soto. Yeah, he might be the most entertaining player in baseball.
I believe so.
It's right up there. Like, you know how when Stanton hits a home run, Giancarlo Stanton hits a home run. It's not just a home run, but it's like a freakish laser show thing.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like an extra level of entertainment value. In Soto, it's in the body language, it's in the at-bats, it's in the playing with the pitcher. I don't have to tell you what it is, John.
Yeah, it's like every pitch is entertaining, just to see what his facial expression would be like. Yeah. He's going to toss the ball between his legs and go back to everything that he does.
And have you seen him, when you've been in Citi Field this year, have you seen him kind of play around with the fans in right field too? Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Just where he's going to throw a ball to them at the end of the, you know, where the inning is going to begin, he's play catch, he's going to throw the ball to them. He's kind of like, fakes him out, smiles, and just like everything. Yep. He's just having a good time. And I think it's worth noting that at the beginning of the year, for a while, the Mets coaching staff was wondering, where's the shuffle? Where's this stuff? Where's the theatrical behavior? Soto wasn't doing any of it. He was boring. And so the fact that he's brought it back out is a great indicator that he's settling in.
Yeah, the most fascinating part that I've found with him, and when you watch him now stealing bases, and it seems to me that this is kind of the part of the game of this season that he's enjoying more than anything else, is the fact that now he's stealing and he could actually be a 30-30 player and possibly outside shot of maybe 40-40, because he's got, 37 home runs now?
Yeah,
and he's stealing,
cool.
He's stealing almost every time he's on base.
And I'll tell you, on that, John, Soto is a – this is going to sound weird. He's not quite the offensive player he was in 2024 at this point, believe it or not. But he's a better overall baseball player than he was last year. I come from the vantage of having covered both of those seasons of his in New York. And last year, my take was, this is going to sound harsh, but I think you're going to know what I mean. When Soto was a free agent, I said, he's a Hall of Fame hitter. He's not a great baseball player. And I believe that's been true in his career. Defense, base running. He was not a good base runner last year. This is a weird one. He was a worse defender at Yankee Stadium in right field than he is at Citi Field. Yankee Stadium is an easier right field to play than Citi Field.
Yeah.
But Soto's better this year. It makes no sense. I thought after watching him last year, like, oh, geez, this guy is going to be brutal in right field at Citi Field. I didn't think for a while the Mets should sign him. You don't want to commit to a guy that only hits. He can't even play defense. Yeah. This was a fair way to look at Soto coming out of last year. And he's improved these other facets of his game to become a more complete player, for sure.
Yeah, just to see some of the throws he's even made from right field. And
the
base stealing is just kind of I'm like, wow, is this – this has a lot to do with Anton, doesn't it, at first base, coaching these guys and showing them when to take off and this
– 100%. Good first base coach, good players executing and working on it. And not to sound like a – broken record, but speaking of the scouting thing we were talking about, and this shows how it's league-wide, teams used to have a position called advanced scout, and their job was to literally watch, you know, to watch the opponent next. Like, if the Mets advanced scout this weekend would be on the Phillies and say, the Phillies do this, that, and the other thing, so watch out for that when the Mets get to Philly. Almost no teams have an advanced scout anymore. And this is one of the reasons why the Mets have gotten away with the stolen base thing all season, because an advanced scout would have put a stop to it months ago. Watch them when they get off first. Have the pitcher step off when Soto's out first, because he's doing this running lead, walking lead thing. But they don't have that scouts anymore, so the Mets are taking advantage of that.
In a big way, too. Very big way. Getting to some of the injuries, Jesse Winker off of the season, Tyrone Taylor now on the DL. Francisco Alvarez due to come back, maybe even as early as this weekend. Can you give us an update on what you've heard on Alvarez?
Yeah, he's actually hitting. He's got zero hands that are operative right now, and yet he's hitting and catching. I think he's 4-for-14 in Syracuse.
He hit a grand slam yesterday, I think.
Yeah, so he's hitting fine, and as long as he can do that, then he'll give it a go with the Mets. And obviously the fact that he's able to do it in Syracuse is a huge sign that he can swing a bat. So how about that?
Yeah. Wow. What do they do when Tyrone comes back and Jose Siri is the one guy? It's like, what are you going to do with him? Well, who do you move out of that position? He hasn't played all year. At the limited time he's played, he didn't perform very well. So what kind of decisions are upcoming for the Mets when it comes especially to a guy like Siri, and then Tyrone is coming back and he's an automatic?
Center field's weird right now. It was supposed to be solved a few different times, and it just hasn't quite stuck. I mean, first of all, Ronnie Mauricio is an easy guy to option right now if you have a roster crunch. So that could take care of that. But more the playing time in center, and as it pertains to a postseason roster too, your best team is with a Siri or Mullins is your primary center fielder performing well, and Taylor is your backup outfielder, who's a really winning player in a bench role. You know, Adam Ottavino told me recently that he's never played with a bench player that's as locked in on every pitch when he's not playing than Tyrone Taylor. And that's why he does something smart when he comes off the bench, is because he is like in the game and his eyes and his mind sitting in that dugout all the time. So he has value that way. However, it's just murky because like Siri hasn't played, so it's tough, but I like that pickup for them. All David Stearns wants out of center field is a guy that is a great defender with some power and some offensive upside. Harrison Bader was the guy last year. Jose Siri was supposed to be Harrison Bader this year. Same profile in a lot of ways. He got hurt, so that got disrupted. Then they traded for Cedric Mullins instead of Bader. They talked to the Yankees a little bit about Trent Grisham. There were other center fielders who were being discussed, and they went with Mullins. And, you know, he hasn't performed really. So it's going to be whoever they think helps them win the best. But unfortunately, there's a bit of a, hey, we got Mullins and the trade deadline gave up something for him. So that's in the conversation too. It would be more convenient if he were just performing.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be an interesting end of the season. I got one last thing to talk to you about, and that really is coming up on September the 13th, and that's the Alumni Classic. Terry's going to be back in the dugout. Terry will be in uniform, co-managing Team City Field with Jerry Manuel against Team Shea Stadium with Bobby Valentine and Willie Randolph. Now, for you who've covered the team over all these years, and this is kind of an old timers game, even though we're calling it Alumni Classic. As an insider, do you look forward to promotions like this, games like this? And are there any players that that you look forward to seeing that you may have not seen for a long time?
Is Ike Davis coming back? I think he is.
I believe he is.
That's a great one. He deserves a little bit more love. Like I hope he gets a nice hand. He was such a good guy and had some good time for them before it. Injury derailed his career. Yeah, see Terry in uniforms, obviously, get it. Always cool. It's cool at the old timers game. And yes, I do look forward to them, John. I think that, I maintain a healthy appreciation for not just the history, but the way the fans and the people on the field can interact. And this is just all nice stuff. Like sometimes those interactions in the heat of the moment aren't always positive if fans are mad or something. But this is just like a chance to celebrate and appreciate people who help to provide them with great memories and vice versa. Like it's a nice, I guess, sports and their fan base, the relationships at its best when it's like a back and forth, right? Like we're giving you love and support. You're giving us performance. The energy flows back and forth between the stands and the field. And I guess events like this are a chance for that to just be in its purest, nicest, happiest form. And some nostalgia and memory kicked in. I mean, it's all good. No downside to something like this.
No, it was fun having Terry and Bobby V on together because Terry is like, all right, I'll let you know who my starter is going to be. It's going to be R.A. Dickey, you know. So Terry's looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope to see you out there on the 13th. And we're certainly going to bring you back next time we bring TC on live, which will be right towards the end of the season. I know he's got the big 5K run for Tunnel of Towers on September 28th, which is ironically the last day of the regular season. So we will then regroup with you and Terry and kind of take a look at what's going to be happening in October for the New York Mets. And Andy, as always, a pleasure to have you on. Let everybody know where they could find you on social media. And why don't you give that new book, even though it's not coming out next year, a plug.
I've been working hard on that book, and I'm very excited to share it with Mets fans. It's just it's a book about the history of the franchise with a focus on the Steve Cohen era and how 60 plus years led up to this and what it means. I'm trying to frame what this current what we're seeing now means in the historical scope of the franchise, in addition to fun, juicy insider detail stuff that's always fun to gather. So I'm working on that right now. Thank you for bringing that up. And on social media, at Martino NYC, I'm still calling it Twitter. I'm not calling it what that guy wants me to call it. And on TikTok, I remember, what's my username? Andy Martino. Or I don't look for me on TikTok.
They'll find you. They'll find you. Andy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, John. My pleasure.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
As the season winds down, always a pleasure to have Andy Martino with us, and so many things going on with the Mets, and every game is so important right now. Another thing that's so important, obviously, is the work that the Tunnel to Towers Foundation does week after week, day after day, year after year. This past week, no exception, T2T held a grand opening for its newest veteran village, the facility outside Atlanta. Provides permanent housing for nearly 100 previously homeless vets. The village also includes a full array of supportive services. This is one of more than a dozen Tunnel to Towers projects across the country aiming to eradicate veteran homelessness. You can learn more about the foundation's homeless veteran program at t2t.org. Also, last week, Tunnel to Towers welcomed Army Sergeant Sam Wally into his new specially adaptive smart home. Sergeant Wally lost his right leg and left arm during a roadside bombing in Afghanistan. The house in Georgia is mortgage-free and includes special features like wide hallways and doorways, as well as lights, thermostats, and a security system controlled by a smartphone app. You can help our catastrophically wounded veterans by donating just $11 a month by going to t2t.org. And time is running out. If you'd like to take part in one of the most popular and unforgettable 5Ks in the country, the Tunnel to Towers Run Walk will be held in New York City Sunday, September 28th. Of course, Terry Collins will be part of that. 30,000 plus who will be running in this marathon. Registration is limited, and the event is now almost at capacity. Country music star Chris Jansen will perform at a free post-run concert. You can sign up now at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. And we will return with a special Talking with TC Rewind with one of the most popular and beloved Mets during the Terry Collins era, Curtis Granderson, after this word from Tunnel to Towers.
On Memorial Day, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation honored the heroes who have selflessly served our nation. Among those was Army Sergeant Major Daniel Hendricks. During a special pregame ceremony at Citi Field, Hendricks was surprised by a special announcement by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
Daniel is receiving the keys to his very own mortgage-free smart home.
For Sergeant Major Hendricks, the gift of an accessible home is truly life-changing, a powerful reminder of how we can honor those who have given so much for our freedom.
Mets fans, let's hear it one more time for Daniel Hendricks.
Go t2t.org for more information. Let's go, Mets, and let's help Tunnel Towers.
Today on Talking with TC, our guest is one of the all-time favorites of Mets fans. He was a part of the 2015 National League Championship team where along with Daniel Murphy, he was one of the most productive hitters in the lineup in the postseason that year. He played for the Mets from 2014 to 2017. Other stops in his illustrious career were stints with the Detroit Tigers, New York Yankees, Los Angeles Dodgers, Toronto Blue Jays, Milwaukee Brewers, and Miami Marlins. He's a three-time All-Star, a Silver Slugger Award winner, a recipient of the Roberto Clemente Award in 2016, and has been named the Marvin Miller Man of the Year four times. He's also worked as a baseball analyst for TBS. His ongoing mission with the Curtis Granderson Foundation has benefited inner-city children in Chicago and other cities as well. And he's a board chair for the Baseball Players Alliance. What a resume. It is our pleasure to welcome Curtis Granderson to the Terry Collins Show. Curtis, welcome to Talking with TC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for that introduction.
Well, you deserved it, Curtis. Thanks for coming on today. And, you know, we're just going to have some fun talking about some times. You know, of course, every time I do these shows, Curtis, or I go out, everybody, you know, they always ask me about, you know, what it was like in 2015. That was all these Mets fans, you know, that's all they can remember pretty much of all the whole time I was with New York. So, you know, I always ask anybody who was on those teams. Matter of fact, we had Sandy Alderson on the show one time where I asked him. So, you know, during 2015, all of a sudden we started making deals. What was, as a player on the team, tell us, what was your thought process as we brought in all of a sudden Kelly Johnson and Uribe and the pitching and then finally Cespedes? I mean, what were you guys thinking in that clubhouse at that time?
I think there's two things to it, because when you hear the trade deadline, everyone's expecting, this big name is going to come, but you also don't want to lose pieces because we have been clicking. We have been playing well. So you get double nickels over there with Kelly Johnson wearing 55 and Juan Uribe in that just rock hard belly of his that can just hit you out but play anywhere. So those two pieces were amazing. And TC, I don't know if you remember this because you might have still been inside, but the trade deadline ended at 4 o'clock and we're outside for stretch at say 4:05. Nothing happens. So we're like, all right, let's just walk on the field and get ready to get our stretch done. This is the team we have. This is the team we're going to finish 2015 with. It's solid. Let's go. And as soon as we got on the field for stretch, that's when the rumor started to break about the Cespedes trade. And we're like, is it true? Is it not? Because the deadline has passed. But you know how this works in the game. Stuff is still rolling in. It's still being confirmed and still being announced. But we as the players, we didn't know. We got a game to play that night. And then boom. Cespedes gets announced and we're like, oh man. And then now you add in with everything else we have going on. And plus the big thing is he came in and clicked. You know, sometimes you get a name that comes in and it just doesn't, it's not the right piece. And he was the perfect piece to that puzzle that we definitely needed. So it was amazing how it all went down. Talk about suspense, talk about excitement. And then boom, the roller coaster just kept going.
You know, Curtis, in all your career, I mean, you were in a lot of, especially late in the season at those trading deadlines, you were in a lot of clubs that, you know, were headed for the playoffs. I mean, you had good teams. And so was this a different situation? I mean, I talked to Sandy about it, I said, you know, I asked him, you know, at what time during the first part of that season did you guys say, hey, look, if we had a couple of pieces, we got a chance here. Did you guys always think that was the same in that clubhouse? Were you guys saying, you know, if we get a couple pieces here, we got a chance to win this thing?
You know what? It's funny because we started out so well. We were hot. We were rocking. The crowd was amazing. And then we were traveling well on the road. And you started seeing the seven line and the blue and the orange just coming not only in the hotels, but in the stadiums around the towns. So you were sensing and feeling it. But we felt like what we had was solid. Not saying that we were set. We would have loved to have pieces, but we didn't think of any of the pieces that Sandy brought in as, okay, yeah, we're missing a Clipper, we're missing a Reed, we're missing a Uribe, we're missing a Kelly Johnson, and of course a Cespedes. I think you're just so into the moment of the season and just continuing to go that every day until they tell you something, that's when you start to think about it. So it never crossed my mind. Like, and your door was always open. We never came to talk to you and said, hey, TC, you know, we're missing something. We got to get this piece or this piece. And same thing with Sandy. You know, it was never a topic of conversation. We were just out there one day at a time, one series at a time, having a ton of fun. And for everyone that watched, I mean, we were always having a good time. But you can have a good time when you're prepared and you're also going out there and doing what you're supposed to do. That's what we did. We focused on what we needed to focus on and didn't necessarily think about those pieces until the deadline day, because we knew we were in it and we knew something was going to happen. So we just wanted to know what it was going to be. We just had no idea. Did we need a position player? Did we need a pitcher? Did we need a reliever? We were just like, all right, something's going to happen. Just what is it going to be?
Yeah. You know, I tell everybody, yeah, especially people who, you know, they think players don't pay attention. You know, I said, look, don't ever think players are naive. They know exactly what's going on. They listen. I said, matter of fact, half the rumors get started by players talking because, you know, they have this time on their hands before a game where, hey, there's conversations about the game itself going on, or maybe a trade someone else made, you know? So I said, you know, I think you guys get a bad rap sometimes by, oh, they don't care about anything else except their own selves. And that's not true. That is, I mean, all good teams I've ever been on, I'm telling you, there's conversation, baseball conversation going on daily.
Yeah, we're definitely not in the point where it's not, we don't care. It's just that, you know, our focus is on try to control as much as you can. Because I remember being rumored in a trade early in my career and it kind of got to me a little bit like, oh, am I going to go? Am I not? And then nothing happened. So I stepped back and said, all right, unless something happens, I'm not going to focus on it too much. I know that those things end up going on throughout the course of the game and we're seeing and we're watching, especially with players that are represented by agencies that have other players on other teams. So there's conversations that are happening. And now, which is, you know, almost 10 years removed from 2015, with social media, with friends and family all on it, anything that pops and your name is associated to it, even if you're not trying to look at it, someone's calling you up. Hey, did you hear this? Is it true? Someone's sending you a text, someone's sending you a tweet, someone's sending you a DM. So you try to avoid it, but it's all around you. At least back then, you could kind of like not look at the paper. You could turn the TV off and you might be a little bit shielded from it, but it's tough right now. So even if you want to stay away from it, you can't.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, Curtis, as I look back and some of the things you did, one of the things that you did that I'm telling you that I don't, and again, I look at the special teams today and it happens, you played every day. I mean, I look, you, how many, there was like, I mean, maybe 8 years, you played 160 games in a year. Did you, I mean, I remember, at times, I remember going up to you and saying, hey, do you need a day this week? Hey, I'll get you a day this week. And you, you know, you being yourself just said, well, you know, I'll be fine. If you want to give me a day, give me a day. You're the manager. But I mean, you went out there, man, 160, that's a lot of games.
Hey, that's the way I looked at it. You're the one in charge. You were the manager and a great manager. So you tell us, unless there's something like I'm ailing really bad, then I'll say something. But again, that's very rare. And I found later in my career how to go at 100%, how to pull back just enough not to damage anything, but to still give you everything that you need and what the fans expect. But you did something that I still remember to this day. And I tell so many young players about it. I had like a little calf or something going on. And you and I were trying to figure out the plan. Hey, do we take a day? Do we take 2 days or three, whatever the case is going to be? So we missed the first day. And then the second day, I said, I think I'm good to go. And you said, no, I'm going to give you one more day. I'd rather you miss one day than me put you out there. You blow out and I'm missing you for 2 or 3 weeks. So even those little things, although I played all the time, I knew, okay, I just need to pull back today. And then I can give you another 20 days in a row. But if I keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing, I'm not going to make it to the 20. And that was all part of you. So I'm not sure if I ever got a chance to credit you and thank you for that. But I remember us having that conversation. And I tell so many young players about it. Even when you feel great, you might just need one more day. And that one more day can get you through everything. Don't push through it. And then all of a sudden we're missing you for a period of time. And that was the part. And I think the keys that allowed me the opportunity to get to the 160s. I may need a day. I may need just a couple innings. Whatever the case it is, just give me just that, and then I can give you everything else.
Curtis, you know, you played all three outfield positions. Was there one that you said, boy, this is where I like to play? Or did you just say, hey, I moved you to right field. You saw, I'm going to go play right field. Was it no big deal, or was there, did you say, man, I wish I could back in center field? I mean, I know we got you played you in center.
Right. It was weird.
One spot you really liked more than the others?
you know, I started my career when I got drafted and left, and then really learned that and really enjoyed it, then ended up in center, made it to the big leagues in center. And then I think the first time I was officially in right was with the Mets. But I had played right in college, and I think right field is the easiest one to play. So when you put me out there, I was like, yeah, I hadn't been there in a while, but this kind of felt like second nature. So I was good out there. Plus, our dugout was on first base, so it was a little like short jog out there. So I liked that side of it.
But well, there were Curtis, I'm telling you, I've told a lot of people playing right field in Citi Field, that place is tough in right field. Yeah. You know, they got that overhang,
bump outs, and the moving and everything. But the one thing I felt like, especially with Tom Goodwin, you know, he was so good. We got our work in out there. I just knew exactly where I needed to be to help make that as easy as it could be. Of course, still challenging, but this. We always worked. If I was playing or not playing, I definitely went out there and got my fly balls and ground balls, and I wanted to see the work. And then, especially with the number of right-handed hitters in batting practice, they would always work to right field. So I got a lot of balls out there just to see throughout the course of the game. So that made it comfortable out there. And then as we started to transition to, hey, you're going back to center, there'd be times I'm like, I'm the oldest guy on this team. How come I'm playing center field? There's some fresh legs over here. But I loved it. It was great because I had everything in front of me, and the corner outfielders, no matter who it was, whether it was Cespedes or Conforto or Deaza, whoever it happened to be, I just had to move them one way or the other, and they listened. So I was like, all right, you move this way, you move this way. Let's blanket this as best as we can, move in, move back. But they also, I gave them respect. So if they saw something, move me. Hey, if I'm too shallow, if I'm too deep, let me know. And I was never going to say, you know, stop talking, even although I'm the oldest one out here. I want to hear whatever information can make me better. And hopefully you respect whatever I'm going to give you to make you better. So I had fun out there. So whichever one you happen to put me into, it was always a good time. But then on the flip, as the career got later, when I went back to left, I felt lost a little bit. It's like,
no kidding.
I was out there. I was like, I hadn't been here in a little bit. Hit it to me in during this time of the game when we're up a lot or down a lot. So hopefully I don't mess this thing up. So I never said that because obviously I couldn't let anybody know. But there were times out there I was like, please don't hit it to me. Please.
I mean, when you went to Miami, were you in left field at that time? Because that's a tough left field.
Yeah. So I had to get back out there. And going prior to that, when I was in Toronto, Devon White was key. So I said, hey, I haven't been out in left in a while. He's like, all right, let's get out there. Let's go out there and let's make this, you know, less of a liability and more of a strength. So that helped me to make it more comfortable because he was great at pushing me out there. Tom Goodwin was great at pushing me out there. And the reason I played center at the level I did was Andy Van Slyke with Detroit. They all just kept pushing in that spot. And I said, let's go. We got to get as good as we can out there. And those three were very key in my career throughout being the outfielder that I was.
Wow, I didn't know you had Andy in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. He was out there running us crazy out there. He would do drills. They'd have to pull him back and say, hey, you know, we're going to blow out these guys. I mean, he had us running and running and running. But that's how he learned. That's why he was so good. So we did as much of it as we could until the trainer stopped it. But that's why I was able to play center field in Detroit, because my scouting report, if anyone finds it, says that I was not fast enough to play center field, especially in Detroit. And that's where I played a majority of my center field. But that was because of Andy Van Slyke.
Wow, that's cool. You know, I was in Pittsburgh when Andy was Andy that just got to the Pirates, and I saw Bill Verdon do that stuff with those guys. I mean, at the end of the day, he ran those guys in the ground going after balls. But, you know, again, I forgot about Andy being out there because they all got better. Even Barry got better. Bobby Bonilla got better, all because of those drills they did before. So,
and if you remember, like if you had a spring training game and you weren't playing, that was a great day. You just took batting practice, took a couple fly balls, then you were done. Andy said, you wanted to play. You did not want to stay back, because if you stayed back, that's when you got crushed. And sure enough, Andy had the same mentality. So I was hoping I was playing. 3-hour bus ride, I didn't care. Let me go on the road. But those days I stayed back, that's what got me better.
Wow. You know, today, Randy, you watch guys today. I mean, they're very few guys. I mean, I talked like, you know, last year the Braves had like four guys that played 160 games. The Mets, you know, with Lindor and Pete, they play a lot of games. I mean, I'm shocked today that, you know, there's not more guys that play 155, 160 games. You know, I think the training staff is so concerned about these guys due to being overworked that, you know, that they think that's leading to injury. But, you know, you didn't have very many injuries.
No, you know, outside of, I mean, I got hit by pitches, which is something out of my control. So that happened to me twice one year right before I came over to the Mets. But, you know, the time we were there, like I said, I had a little calf thing here. I think I had maybe a little hammy thing, but I was like, all right, I understand what's going on. Let's talk. Let's get a plan. Let's not push through it. But listening to the body, understanding when I needed to hydrate, when I needed to pull back, when I could go full board in the weight room, when I had to pull back. So that's where I feel like just the transparency and the communication was such a key thing. And what we did a really good job with that Mets organization at that time is there was just a lot of talking. And I would come in, let them know how I felt. They would tell me what I'd feel. If I was supposed to do 5 sets of workout today, I said, hey, can we do 3? I still did the work. I didn't shy away from it. But hey, let's pull back. Or hey, I'm feeling really good. Let's go a little bit more. And it was those little things, I think, that just helped. But you can't just keep going like every day is the first day of spring training, especially when it's June and July and August and you've played 80, 90, 100 games. I can't lift like I was doing on day one. I have to modify it. So that means lower the weights, lower the reps, lower the number of swings, lower the number of ground balls. We get a good off day. We come back from the All-Star break. Now we can start to ramp up and add in. But if you just keep going and going and going, it's like the example they give with the car. I mean, I can keep flooring it, but eventually I'm going to run out of gas, plain and simple. And it's the same thing with the body. You just can't keep pushing it. So I think there's that balance of give and take on wonder how you can keep going and keep coasting, still stay ready. And I think that's one of the challenges. A lot of players don't think they're ready if they don't do everything every day. At this point in time, especially come like October, if I haven't figured it out by now, it's too late, you know. So, you know, I'm not going to get it done today. Yeah. You know, I got to keep going and going all the previous stuff. And if you think about just adding the number of swings, TC, if we're in the cage, I take my rounds off the tee. I take my soft toss. I may hit off the machine. Then we come out for the field and we do our 5 to 6 rounds of batting practice. And I do that every day. By the time we get to June and July, I'm over thousands of swings. It's okay to miss 10. It's okay to miss 20 at this point in time. But I'm still going to get my work in. And you saw it towards the end. Sometimes I would just take BP in the cage.
Right.
I don't need to come on the field and hit at this point in time.
Right.
I'm gonna take my fly balls and then I'm going to come off, rest up. And I think those things help me out a lot.
Yeah, I always thought, you know, especially a veteran guy, he knows how to keep himself ready and what he needs to do. I mean, especially at the end of summers, you know, you have batting practice because some guys like to take batting practice. Like you didn't. There was a time, I think, I can't remember if it was 15 or 16, you know, Seth, for the last month, he just hit inside. He didn't hit on the field anymore. I think you got to know yourself a little bit and, you know, go from there. And that's why to have veteran leadership in the clubhouse, yep, it helps some of these young guys because they want to work and work and work. So they're showing everybody, hey, look, I'm working hard so I can keep playing. When you're right, once in a while, you got to back off a little bit.
It's okay. Rest is part of the success, right? We strength, we eat, we train, we do all that stuff, but rest is also one of those big key components. So adding that side to it is okay. And Cespedes is one of the best. He worked all the time, but when it was time for him to rest, he rested with the best of them. I mean, remember that game that we had where he did the pinch hit home run? I think he was on the massage table when you were asking him to come into the game. I tell that story all the time.
He didn't have his uniform on anymore. He had his gym shorts and his. I said Pat Russell, and I said get Seth ready. And he came back out. He goes, you know, he's in his gym shorts and T-shirt. I said, okay. And he walks up and hits a homer. I mean, that's just
was him. Announced his name. Remember, he's taping his wrist still. And it's like, what are we going to do here? He hasn't even swung the bat yet today. Then he comes up and boom, hits the home run. The crowd goes nuts. It's crazy. But he had been putting miles and miles prior to. So this isn't, hey, I haven't done this every day. I've been putting my work in. Today is one of those days where, hey, I'm not in the lineup. I'm going to take the game flowed and shifted where all of a sudden we needed him, but he's ready. The car has been running. The engine has been on. So that's why he was able to come in and do that stuff. And that's the part where people miss. Like, oh, he doesn't do work. He's doing the work. Just because you don't always see it all the time doesn't mean that he's not doing the work.
Right.
And he worked. I mean, He's probably the last true five-tool player that I have seen in person. When he'd run into run, he was the fastest individual I saw. The best arm. His BP power was amazing. I mean, he was going third deck at Citi Field. Hit for average, and he has a gold glove. So he was able to put it all together, but that's because of the work. He was my throwing partner. That's why we were able to throw so well, because I was throwing with Cespedes. That's how my arm improved a little bit, because I hadn't had a solid throwing partner in a while. So to get Cespedes back there was great for me.
That's cool. So, John, I know you've got some Curtis Granderson questions you want to ask.
Yes, thanks, Terry. Appreciate it very much. Curtis, the Mets signed you to a four-year free agent contract prior to the 2014 season, following your 4 years with the Yankees. What was it like for you to play for both New York teams? Compare the similarities and the differences between the Mets and the Yankee fans.
My one regret is I wish I would have bought something in New York. If I'd have known I'd have been there for 8 years, I would have had some real estate, but I didn't know I was going to be there that long. Even with the Yankees, I was there with 3 years left on my deal and a team option, which they then picked up. Then I become a free agent, and you just never know what free agency is going to unfold. I had no idea that the Mets would be in the mix until free agency happened. And then it was in the mix, and I met with Sandy, and everything started to move real quick, and boom, now I'm with the Mets. And ironically, as soon as I sign and I come do my physical at HSS, because I stayed near there, I stayed at 72nd and York, I left my physical, ran to my old apartment and asked if it was available for the next year, and started the process of signing my lease for the next year. And that's just how everything was so conveniently located. So from that side of it, it was so cool. From the Yankee fan base, I was there for the final four, or the big four wrapping up their careers with Jeter and Pettit and Posada and Rivera. So the treatment that we received just traveling nationwide was so cool, and going in Serrano, because people wanted to see them for their last games and for their last hurrahs. They had been there for all those championships. So that side of it was just so unique and so awesome to see. Now you fast forward and come over to the Mets. And again, kind of like what we just talked about, I didn't play in Shea Stadium. I never played there throughout the course of my career. And the only time I played the Mets was once in 2007. They came to the Tigers in interleague play, and then during the Subway Series with the Yankees. So we focused on that series, and then we were on to the AL East or the AL Central. So I didn't know much about the Mets prior to. So as we get in, and 14 was, you know, an average season. I think we finished 500, got a slow start, finished hot at the end, but wasn't enough to do anything. Then 15 happens and we start rolling. And then all of a sudden this energy came like something I had never seen. Like, it was just loud. It was intense. The fans were on the road. They were taking over the road cities. I mean, you'd see just blue and orange around the hotel, around the restaurants. And I was like, this is intense. It's insane, but it's awesome at the same time. So from that side of it, it started to mirror what I had seen from the Yankees, just traveling fan bases that wanted to be there to support, that were loud and proud to let you know that they were a Yankee or a Mets fan. And we had success on both sides. So from that side of it, it was so cool. And the biggest thing that I tell everybody, if you want to hear the loudest boos ever, Citi Field. But if you also want to hear the loudest cheers, also Citi Field. Like, and I've been booed at Citi Field. My 14 didn't start off great. They come at you, and probably one of the biggest boos that we ever heard was when they announced Chase Utley in the NLDS. Woo! That was intense. And if you remember, TC, they did the player introductions, and they showed, I think it was Kershaw, and then it was Jimmy Rollins, and they put the camera on Chase Utley, and they kept it on him. And they didn't move. Like, you got to move the camera. You got to get it off of them. And then we played into it. We had Ruben Tejada come out there with the cane and limp out there. Yeah, so All that stuff was just crazy to see firsthand. But on that side of it, they rocked when the place was great. But when they were ready to boo, they came down with the hammer on you over there with Citi Field. And I think that's what makes it so exciting on both places.
Yeah, I was at that playoff series in New York, and they left that graphic. They left that shot of Utley up a really, really long time. Yes, and he got an earful for sure. That was very, very exciting. But this question's for both of you. Curtis, when you came to the Mets, obviously Terry Collins was going to be your skipper, And Terry, you were getting a leader. You were getting an amazing player to be part of your team. Curtis, first to you, then to Terry. What did Terry Collins mean to you as skipper of the Mets? And give us your best Terry Collins story. And then, Terry, please respond with your memories of Curtis Granderson and what your reaction was when the Mets signed him. Curtis first.
So my first time meeting Terry was at the winter meetings. We were up in a suite in Orlando. So I come in there and there's a few other individuals finally getting a chance to meet, excited. And then we go out there, do the press conference, and then we leave. So I don't see TC until spring training just because just the way the flow of the offseason goes. So we get to spring training and he's coming up to you and talking to you and asking, okay, what do you want to do for spring training? What do you want for your bats? What do you want for your games? How many innings do you want? So on and so on. So we're just having those conversations, which I enjoy. I mean, I take it for granted, but a lot of times people just don't talk throughout the baseball world for whatever reason. But he was always talking. And even as games would unfold, I would start to move down in the locker or in the dugout and just be closer towards, you know, all the coaching staff and kind of joke with them a little bit, talk with them, hear what they're talking about and seeing as the flow of the game's going on and then come back. And then two funny stories with TC. The first one is when we get Tebow. So Tebow comes and joins us and TC comes to me and goes, look, if there is a ball between the two of you, do not run into him because you are not going to win. And Tebow was just shredded. I mean, he was just such a just solid specimen. So I took that lesson for sure. I was not running into TC.
No.
And then the second thing, you mentioned in the bio, you know, the fact that we had a solid postseason. So there were all these rumors about TC throwing amazing batting practice to Barry Bonds. And he would get Barry going. So we win the NLCS and we have a gap before the World Series. And TC goes, I'm going to come out and throw BP. I've never seen TC throw. TC comes out and he's throwing 80 miles an hour. He is firing that thing in there. But it was as close to game-like scenario and it locked me in. I was ready. That's why I had a good World Series for that. I mean, guys were stepping out of the cage like, nope, I'm not breaking my bats. I'm not doing that. TC was humping and throwing that thing up there. But it was great, and I see why Barry was able to do. I mean, it was strikes. It was velocity. It was intense. And I don't know how much BP Terry had been throwing all season long, but he was in shape in October and ready to go.
Well, I didn't throw as much as I wanted to throw, I can tell you that, Curtis. We had so many coaches. And, you know, in New York, you have so much other responsibilities. You know, you have so much media you got to take 2 minutes for. But, yeah, I'll tell you, Barry, I threw for about 4 years in a row, I threw all the batting practice Barry Bonds had. If he hit, I threw it. So we used to hit. Matter of fact, we had big bets and everything else. But, yeah, I used to love to throw it. But, you know, I think about Curtis. You know, when we got the trade, obviously, I'm from Michigan. So, I mean, I'd heard all the Curtis Granderson stories from the guys with the Tigers because they, you know, I was a Tiger fan. So I couldn't wait. And I knew what he brought to the team. And, you know, and of course, we weren't Yankee Stadium anymore. We didn't have that little short right field fence that they did in Yankee Stadium. But you know what? He never changed. He never got out of his game. He just kept doing what he did best. But his presence in the locker room, you know, you don't hear a lot about the kind of leadership he is, but I'm going to tell you something. Without Curtis Granderson in 2015, Lucas Duda would not have been the player he was in 2015. You kept him. You got him, Curtis. You took him from this introverted guy to a fun-loving guy with a big smile on his face every day. And I'm thinking, what? And then I started finding out you were taping him and you were following him around. What was that about, that whole thing? But that, I'm telling you, that's the kind of stuff, John, when, you know, people think leaders, oh, they give speeches and stuff. That's not always true. You know, he just took this guy and made this guy just a better person to be around. It was a tremendous job with that. You got to tell me about that story.
I just wanted to have fun over there, but also know that we can work first and then, of course, still enjoy. It doesn't always have to be 100% serious. So I don't know if you all did it strategically or not, but my locker was next to Duda's. So once my locker was next to his, and I always tried to gravitate towards other left-handed bats. So I think Duda even asked me something about swinging left-handed, and that's how it started. So there was the spring training, we're talking, and then all of a sudden the season rolls, and Instagram had become this huge thing. And everyone's like, dude, you got to get on social media. He's like, I don't want any part of it. Like, okay, we'll make a social media page for you, Duda. We follow Lucas Duda, and we're going to just hound him and get pictures and get videos and get all these crazy things about him. And he hated everything about it, but I think secretly he loved it because he knew he didn't have to do it, and he could just go out there and do it. So not only we had the kitchen staff, we had the trainers, we had everybody in was just trying to snap that photo. It was like we were the paparazzi trying to get him, but he went off. And I would just constantly keep messing with him. So we're in Dodger Stadium during the NLCS, and he's taking batting practice, and he hits a ball that goes to the top of the bleachers, and it breaks one of the signs, one of their billboard signs. Mind you, this is the middle of a playoff game. TC, I don't even know if you knew this happened. I run inside. I go to the office and get some Dodger letterhead, and I write up on it, say, hey, this is Dodgers ownership. You know, that sign cost us $5,000. We're going to put that straight from Mets payroll. And I put it on his chair. Now, this is this might have been game five. We go to Dodger Stadium for game five, right? That's how I wanted to keep it going. Like, the game is going to be pressure enough. How do we loosen it up? So I put that on his chair. He's reading. He's like, Grandy, is this true? I was like, I don't know. I mean, it says you have to pay it, so you might have to get that paid. And sure enough, you know, we finally joke, laugh. We go out, we win game five, and then we get ready to go to play the Cubs. So that's why I always try to just keep it loose and relaxed. And even one time we're in Atlanta. I don't know why, but remember when I bought the dodgeballs?
Yes.
We're playing team dodgeball in the visiting locker room before a game. I mean, you shouldn't have had DeGrom throwing a dodgeball or Wheeler throwing a dodgeball, but we were, and we're hitting guys. Guys are diving over couches and chairs, and then we go out and win. But I always wanted to keep the element of having the game fun, because it still is the same game that we started playing when we were little. There's just a lot more people watch us now, and the field's just a little bit bigger, but it still should be fun. And that was the way that I tried my best to lead. And I think a lot of guys were receptive to it.
I would say they were, yeah.
Absolutely. That's great stories there. Well, what a beloved team that is and always will be. And next year is going to be 10 years already, so time flies, I tell you.
Welcome to Paris Pizzeria. Your blind date is already at the table, and here she is. Cousin Brenda, what are you doing here? You're married anyway.
Substitution brought to you by Paddy Power. Cousin Brenda makes way for Beth, the office crush.
Oh, get in! You might not always pick the right starter, but your sub can still deliver. Because with Paddy's Super Sub, your bet rolls over to the player coming on. Paddy Power.
Valid on selected leagues and markets only. Pre-match and in-play bets on qualifying player outcome selections only. T's and C's and exclusions apply. 18+. Gambleaware.org.
Curtis, you made it to the World Series with the Tigers and the Mets. What was it like to be a young player in 2006 in comparison to that veteran player who played for the Mets in the 2015 Fall Classic? And give us your favorite memory or moment of that 2015 season.
Well, you know, in 2006, you know, I'm excited just to make the team. I have another young, just all-star, who's amazing that he's still playing right now, Justin Verlander. He makes the team with me that year. So we're the young presence on that team, but we have just veteran stars, Kenny Rogers, Magleor Ordóñez, Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, and just they take you underneath their wing and just show you how to go about doing it. But you also watch. Okay, they're good for a reason. Let me see why they're so good. And you're getting a chance to watch. And they were receptive. Like, they didn't haze us. They didn't do anything crazy. I think that had just started to shift at that time, which was great. So we were able just to fit in, be ourselves, and enjoy. And we literally were a team with the 2006 Tigers, to the point where in 2007, the year after, we lose like the last week of the season, get eliminated from playoff competition in Chicago. So I was like, all right, you know, we're done, but obviously we're still going to finish up the season strong. So let's enjoy ourselves this evening. Now, mind you, when you have a team like that, the young players kind of do their thing. The veteran players do their thing. We all went out together that evening, had dinner, had a good time. And I remember Kenny Rogers coming up to me afterwards, goes, I had no idea where the hotel was. I'm trying to make it back to the hotel. It's 4 a.m. I don't remember where the hotel is. So he made it back. He wasn't pitching. But I say that because you very rarely get teams that are like that. Fast forward to 2015, we had that again. We had that team that we ate together, we hung out together, we did all these amazing things, from the dodgeball to chasing after Duda in the clubhouse, on the field, and when it was time to go to this different city, we did stuff. So, for example, we're in Chicago. I host the summer. I host a camp here at UIC, University of Illinois Chicago, my alma mater. I invite the players to come out to the camp. I'm not expecting everybody to say yes. The players, the coaching staff, the trainers all came to support my camp. That's the type of team that we had in 2015 as well, which was very similar to the team and the chemistry we had in 2006, which was big keys to why I think we were so successful. That team literally became that, an entire team from top to bottom, whether you were a rookie like I was in 06 or you were a veteran like I was in 2015. Everybody had an important role and everybody was respected.
Thank you. One more and then I'll throw it back to Terry. You've been a leader on and off the field throughout your career. SNY's Andy Martino reported that prior to the 2022 season, Buck Showalter wanted you to be his bench coach, which you declined at the time. Can you see a time when you might want to put the uniform back on as a coach or a manager in the MLB?
The answer clear is right now as I talk to you is an absolute no. And I'm going to explain why. And it's actually because of Terry. This isn't a bad thing, but it happened with Terry and Dick Scott and Ricky Bonus. We're in Atlanta. I go get breakfast in the morning. We have a night game. I'm coming back to the hotel. It's probably 12:30. I'm getting in the hotel. TC and the rest of the staff are dressed just like you see now. They have their polos on. They're ready to go to the ballpark. So I see them. I ask, oh, are you going to get something to eat? They go, no, we're going to the ballpark. I get nervous. I thought the game time got bumped up. I said, is the game's at 7, right? They said, yeah, but we got to go. We got meetings. We got to lift. We got to do our reports. We got to do all this stuff. I said, right now? I go, yeah, this is what time we go. Then you fast forward. The game doesn't end until 11:30, and the last bus is an hour after that. So they're at the ballpark from 12:30 to 12:30 every day. And at that moment, I said, there's no way I can do that. That is way too long of a day. But I have such a great deal of respect for all the coaches and the managers I've ever had because that's the type of stuff that they do. And they're just constantly there getting notes, getting prepared, getting the team situated, getting everybody just situated across the board, that it just takes time. And I'm like, I don't know if I can dedicate that much time, 162 games, plus the playoffs, plus spring training. I mean, you got to dedicate February 15th to October 15th every year. So TC, I don't know how you did it, but thank you, because it takes a certain person to do it. And in that moment, I was like, nope, I'm not going to do it.
Thank you. Back to you, TC.
Well, Curtis, you brought up, you know, you talked about, you know, dedication and things you do. I want to talk about your off the field things that you do, because it is off the charts. And I don't know how many people know about some of these things. I mean, I went to the camp that you had. John, he didn't bring up the fact that do you still have the cupcake?
I still got the cake balls. Yeah. So
yeah, my God, he'd bring, they good. We'd go to Chicago and he'd bring these cake balls in. And if you weren't one of the first 6-7 guys, you may not get one. They went so fast. But I want to know how the academy's going. Are you still running that in Chicago? I mean, can you tell the fans of what that consists of? Cause it is an amazing feat that you do.
So at UIC, I helped build the stadium in 2014. And part of that, I wanted to be able to give the opportunity for the community of Chicagoland area, boys and girls, kids ages 8 to 18, an opportunity to practice, play, and train all year long. That includes outdoors and indoors. Because as you know, Chicago has very similar weather to New York. When you get to those winter months, you got to be inside. But the way the game has gone, training year-round has become more of just a regular type of thing that you have to have if you can afford to have indoor space. So with Chicago Baseball and Educational Academy, also called CBEA, We are one of three indoor facilities in Chicago that offers up the space for everybody. We have Major League infield on the inside, so it's where I practice and train in the offseason. Players like Jason Kipnis, TJ McFarland, Luke Gregerson, just to name a few, would also train there in the offseason. But it's the only one that offers us up for free to those kids in the community. So we have that going on. And plus, when the weather is great in the outside, in the summertime, we get them outside. And I argue we have the best view in all of baseball because you have the Chicago skyline in our outfield right there. So we do those great things with CBEA. It's been going on now since 2016. So we're coming up on 10 years for that. And we're still moving and grooving. We actually have a Major League Wiffle Ball series going on July 27th. So proceeds from that are going to help benefit CBEA as well. So bring out the crazy moving, sliding and grooving balls and all that good stuff and have a little event tied to that as well.
So Curtis, do you still have the, still help the kids with school? There's educational stuff that they, when they come in?
Yeah, so the Curtis Granderson Foundation still gets involved with that. We've taken a couple shifts on a few of those things. So when we initially started it, I started the foundation in 2007 in Detroit, where the high school graduation rate was only at 50%. Both of my parents taught in the Chicago public school system. My sister currently and still teaches at the university level. And at the time, I was one of a handful of Major League Baseball players with a college degree. So we really focused a lot on education to get things going. We then added Fighting Childhood Obesity with Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. So we got you active, we got you focused, but then we also realized those two are connected, but if you aren't properly nutritioned and have a meal and you're food insecure, meaning you don't know where your next meal is coming from, forget focusing in the classroom, forget moving around and staying active. So we've shifted a lot of it to fighting food insecurity, but all of it ties back into together, again, just trying to help you be the best you that you can be by making sure you're properly nutritioned, that you continue to stay active, and of course, education is an option for you.
So Curtis, tell me about the Baseball Alliance, their Major League Alliance. I know you were the president. Are you still the president of that? And yes. So how did that get started? Who started that?
So I serve as the board chair for the Players Alliance, which was started in 2020. Three players, D. Gordon, Cameron Maben, and Edwin Jackson were the three founding members of that. Edwin Jackson still serves as a founding board member, and then C.C. Sabathia serves as our vice chair. So we started that in 2020. All about trying to take things that we had heard from the previous generations that we've had conversations about how do we provide more opportunities for black ball players in this game. So players like Dave Winfield, Willie Horton, Mookie Wilson, just to name a few, we had had these conversations. We just couldn't collectively come together consistently because life was happening. Baseball was going on. Families were happening. People were in the playoffs. People weren't in the playoffs. But in 2020, everybody was sitting home. Everybody figured out how to do video chats like we're doing right now. So we're able to get everybody collectively together and bridge that gap and say, all right, let's push forward and keep this thing going. With partnership with Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball, we now have some things in place where we're going out to different communities across the U.S. where we know black participation is there, but also areas of poverty, because poverty doesn't see color. So there's white individuals, there's Asian, there's Latino, there's black, there's brown, there's everybody that is hoping that they can have an opportunity to play, but financially they're struggling. They don't have uniforms, they don't have fields, they don't have enough for coaches, they don't have enough to go to showcases, and we can come in and try to provide ways to be able to help in a number of different ways there. So truly excited for that. And we also do, during MLB All-Star, we do our Game Changers event where we honor and give flowers to those that helped pave the way for us in that major league city. So with the Texas Rangers, we honored Gary Matthews Jr., Fergie Jenkins, Prince Fielder from his time with the Rangers, Darren Oliver, Mark McLemore, Tony Beasley, and Marcus Semien, just to name a few. So it's just great that, you know, we get a chance to show the players from before, the legends, the Hall of Famers, those veterans. I'm now in that recently retired area. The current players, the all-stars, the ones that your kids and your grandkids are looking up to, and that next generation of player coming up. And that's what we're really trying to focus on, is that pipeline of talent and accessibility just to continue to keep you in the game for as long as you want to be in it.
Well, I will tell you, Curtis, that is an absolutely tremendous thing you're doing from your education camp to your grandkids to the Alliance. I mean, what you're giving back to people who are less fortunate than yourself is absolutely amazing. And that's what makes it such an honor to know you and to be around you to see this. And John, that's one of the reasons why he can't get back into managing and coaching. He's being pulled in so many different directions right now. He doesn't know, you know, it's probably hard for him every morning. He probably has to get up and look at that schedule, what I've got in today's, you know, but he's the best, and I really appreciate it. And so, John, I know you've got some questions from some fans, so we'll go to those.
All right. Thank you, Terry. And Curtis, it's been a pleasure. We do have some questions from the fans. Some of them have been answered, like our question from Jack Forrest from Instagram. I'm so pumped for this episode. I love Curtis. Can you ask Curtis about the Instagram account he made for Lucas Duda? That was hilarious. So we kind of covered that one.
Yep.
But anything else you want to expound on lightening Lucas Duda up? And did he eventually get to enjoy that Instagram account?
I don't know if he ever enjoyed it. I think he was happy. Remember when we traded Duda to the Rays, we actually traded the account as well.
Did you really?
So we traded the account to Sergio Romo. And after that point, we kind of lost it a little bit. I still had access to it for a little bit, but I tried to log in and my logins don't work. So I got to see if I can get back to it somehow. And I ran into Duda actually in Florida, West Palm Beach, actually, about 2 years ago. But he's doing well. He's out in California. He's going back to school. So he's doing a lot of great things as well. But, you know, it's just one of those friendships and bonds that was formed before the We Follow Lucas Duda page and still after, because he could have hated me for that. And I know he didn't love it, but we're still cool to this point.
Very cool. We do have a final question here from the fans. It comes from our X account, Starshot9 asks, how big of a WWE fan are you, and did you ever attend WrestleMania?
So very big, not as big now because I don't get a chance to watch it all the time like I used to, but I was very big. My grandmother got me big into WWF at the time because when my grandmother would come to visit, my dad would record the pay-per-views and then my grandma would babysit me. So we'd pop in that VHS of SummerSlam or Royal Rumble or WrestleMania, and I would sit in front with my pillow and pretend to practice all the moves while she sat back and watched me. And that was her way of babysitting. And that's how it just became. So wrestlers like Junkyard Dog and Coco Beware and Rowdy Piper and Hogan and Macho Man and Andre the Giant, you know, that was my introduction to it early on. Then I was a part of the Attitude Era. So, you know, getting a chance to see the Monday Night Wars of Nitro versus Raw. So huge into that, into college side. And then pro baseball, unfortunately, because of the scheduling, we're playing Monday night. We're playing Sundays on pay-per-views and so on. But I did get a chance to attend WrestleMania in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And I tell everybody that it was the best sporting event I've ever been to. And they go, really? What? How? Why? I said, you had 70,000 people there. So I haven't been to very many events that have that many people. That's one. Two, everybody is into it and intense. They know the entrance musics. They know the finishing moves. They're all excited for it. The pyrotechnics are insane, plus the music. So you add all that. The event itself was crazy. And I think that was the one where former President Donald Trump was at that WrestleMania in Detroit. So my parents still have one of the ringside chairs that you can get if you were sitting there, which has Trump as a wrestler at that time on it. So just very iconic just to get a chance to see that. And that was 2008, I think it was, in Detroit. So I've always loved it. I've enjoyed it. I just, you know, don't get a chance to watch it nearly as much as I used to.
Yeah, that was WrestleMania 23, I think you were talking about, at Ford Field. And there was 83,000.
83.
That was crazy. Yep. And that was also the WrestleMania where Donald Trump shaved Vince McMahon's head in the middle of the ring in the Battle of the Billionaires. That was a crazy WrestleMania for sure. But thank you for that. And that was our fan questions. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, thank Curtis, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I know you're a busy guy, and I can't wait to you have this put together. It's going to get out there. People are going to love it. You did a great job. And thanks again for coming on the show. And I hope you stay in touch and get to see you soon.
For sure. Thank you. Always good to see you. Enjoy Florida or Michigan, wherever you end up at TC. It was great playing for you, and thank you so very much for having me.
You bet, pal. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. And Curtis, one other thing. I mean, before we go here today, can you tell everybody out there, if they want to make a donation to any of your foundations or nonprofits, tell them how they could reach you or those foundations?
So the easiest one right now, because we had so many things we talked about, is my nickname, the Grandy Man. So go to grandyman.com. You can check out everything there. We have highlights to take you to CBEA, to take you to the Players Alliance and the Curtis Granderson Foundation. So if you can't remember all the different names, just remember my nickname, search the Grandy Man, and I will pop up and you will get a chance to see what we got going on.
There you go. Well, thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Curtis Granderson on that special Talking with TC Rewind. He's such a great person and was an incredible Met who will be at the Alumni Classic taking place in just a few days. I'll be heading to New York for the Classic and we'll be capturing some exclusive content with Terry Collins at that game, which we're going to feature right here at the Terry Collins Show. And right now, let's feature a special T2T story about our own TC, Terry Collins. Let's go to that right now.
This world doesn't function without the armed forces, first responders who every day put their life on the line. When they retire, when they leave, no matter what's wrong with them, there's somebody there that's going to take care of them forever. And what Tunnels is trying to do to get these veterans help, you know, the $11 a month that's asked, you know, that's not very much money. And yet when you see what it's building, it's off the charts. You know, when you see the response when they walk in and tell some family this house is theirs forever and ever and ever, there's that builds out of their life.
Beautiful.
Oh, cool. Little girls, I'm going to have her own room. That's the part that really warms your heart. And here's a guy, you know, he can say something now and the lights will come on, you know, in the smart home, and it's amazing. You know, when I ran the race, I didn't know what to expect. Crowds and crowds of people at 6 o'clock in the morning. The people that ran the race, they loved it. They loved every second of it. When you come through that tunnel, when you go down in it and you run through all those kids from West Point, you know, that's the future of America you're running by. When you get through that tunnel and you come up the other side, the ROTC from the high schools and the firemen and the police that line it and cheering you on, and you know, the adrenaline just rushes to the point. That's why I said, I'm gonna finish this. I mean, it's one thing when you're just got a t-shirt and gym shorts on. It's another thing when you're carrying fire gear. I just think it's one of the greatest acts of heroism. The only thing he knew is that he had to get there and help out. That drove him, you know? I'm former Mets manager Terry Collins. The Tunnel Towers Foundation is very important to me, and I look for ways to try to support them any way I can. You can support their cause as well by donating $11 a month. Go to t2t.org. Let's go Mets, and let's help Tunnel Towers.
We'll have another T2T story right here on the show next week. And before we go, we want to remind you to check out Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, a New York Mets podcast hosted by the foremost Mets historian. Each week, Jay brings on guests from all eras in Mets history. This week, Jay talks to Edgardo Alfonso, promoting the Alumni Classic and talking about his time with the Mets. He certainly was a special player. Edgardo Alfonso on this week's Amazing Conversations with Jay Horowitz, available on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. And speaking of YouTube, you could subscribe to the Terry Collins Show on your favorite podcast platform or on our YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/the Terry Collins Show. Our entire archives of the past two seasons are available on the platform you listen on, and of course on the YouTube channel as well. All episodes are archived and there for you to enjoy. That'll wrap up this edition of the Terry Collins Show. Thanks to our creative director, Marsh, and to our researcher, Dominic DiBiase. For Terry Collins, this is John Arezzi. We'll see you next time.